Hi everybody, this is Joanne and welcome to another edition of Read Science in collaboration with Scientific American, where I am a blogger, and I'm very pleased to welcome our two guests who are co-authors on the book, The Autistic Brain, Thinking Across the Spectrum. That would be Temple Grandin. Temple, will you say hi?
Hi, it's wonderful to be here.
And her co-author is Richard Panik, and could you say hi?
Hi, everybody. It's great to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
I'm glad you both are here. Now, Temple is well known in two fields. One is for her writing and her communicating about being an autistic person, and has really brought a lot of knowledge to the public and to parents and to people with autism about what it's like to be a person with autism. And Richard is a science writer. He has a Guggenheim Fellowship in science writing, and he is the author of a book called The 4% Universe, which is about dark matter and dark energy, and lays out pretty clearly how that all came to be. So they work together on this book, which Temple's books number many. She has books on how she thinks and how to work with animals, how she understands animals, but this latest book is really more about the science that we know that underlies autism, which of course this is changing as time goes on. So we look forward to a great discussion about not only autism and what we understand about autism these days, but then how do we make this information understandable to the general public? So, because both of you do such a great job in making this information accessible to the public. So why don't I turn it over to Jeff, who will go ahead and ask the first question.
I'm going to dive right in. It's great to be talking to you, Richard and Temple. There are, and this is almost even something that Joanne mentioned, there are a few themes that I'm hoping that we get to talk about that I noticed in this very interesting book that I think are really important and worth discussing. But the one I think I'd want to start with is I'm going to read sort of my question and then the quotation that summed that up for me. I was wondering how much in this shift that you talk about in the book from diagnosis of a disease, as it were, to treating disorders and treating the disorders to a more modern way of recognizing symptoms and causes and working with those came about just because we have advances, incredible advances in types of neurological information we have from things like functional MRI that tell us much more about the brain and how it's going to work. And so here's the question, the quotation I wanted to read, Temple. 20 years from now, you wrote, I think we're going to look back on a lot of this diagnostic stuff and say, that was garbage. So as I see it, we have a choice. We can wait 20 years and several more editions of the DSM before we start to clean up this mess, or we can take advantage of the technological resources that are beginning to become available and start phase three right now. Things have been happening, things are still happening, and I think there's some impatience, but I think it's there's some great direction in this book too. So essay question number one, where have we been, where are we going, and how does this all tie with how we're starting to understand, develop a new understanding of how to approach autism?
Well, if you go through the chapter on the history of the diagnosis, it started out strictly as a psychological disorder, then gradually changed to being a neurological disorder. One of the things about DSM diagnoses is they are behavioral profiles. It's not precise like a diagnosis of tuberculosis. I mean, tuberculosis has not changed over the years. Now, what I think we need to start doing is looking at component parts in autism. Like, for example, some kids have problems with fluorescent light sensitivity. Other kids have problems with sound sensitivity. Some of the work that Walter Snyder did with high-definition MRI at University of Pittsburgh showed that my language output circuit was abnormal. And I had problems with getting speech out, where another child has no problem with getting speech out. Speech comes out very, very fluently. But he may not know what the speech is all about. He might be memorizing movie scripts that he's played over and over again on the on the computer. And so just in the language delays, language problems. There's kind of two basic types. High-definition MRI would have the potential to diagnose those things separately, and that which might change the type of therapy you might do for the language. That's just one example. I don't know if that answers the question or not.
Yeah, I'm good with that. Richard, do you have anything you want to add to that right now?
No, I think Temple said it well, but to go back to your question about maybe what precipitated the change now from a diagnostic or behavioral profile to being more specific, that's definitely, I think, technology-driven. And we say that in the book, the latest advances in neuroimaging and in genetics. And as we, as scientists look along at those specific things, neuroimaging and genetics, that allows us to see it, to see autism, to break it down on a more symptom-by-symptom basis, so that you're addressing the symptoms that might actually belong to more than an autistic population, and trying to figure out where did that come from, how can we address it, how can we possibly perhaps even solve it, the specific problem.
I just want to add, I just want to add one thing on the sensory. People with autism can have sensory problems, and we have a whole chapter in the autistic brain on sensory problems. Also, head injuries can have sensory problems. Yeah. Many, many different developmental abnormalities can have these sensory issues, and they need to be studied based on the type of sensory issues. Is it sound sensitivity? Is it problems with auditory processing, where I don't hear hard consonants very well? Is it a problem with visual processing and flicker on fluorescent lights? These need to be broken out and studied across different diagnostic categories.
But we're actually, in the way that science often advances, we're actually able to see things that we couldn't see before, and this gives us more real neurological basis that can replace the not always so reliable behavioral psychological basis for these things. And that's really giving us a new approach, isn't it?
Well, Temple mentioned Walter Schneider's work at the University of Pittsburgh with his high-definition neuroimaging equipment, which allows us not only to see the parts of the brain that are lighting up, but we can see the passageways. We can see as the technology improves, we're going to see more and more detail. So it becomes a much more precise measure and analysis. Temple, you've been in Walter's machine. Do you want to talk about that?
Well, that was quite an experience. Getting to see my language output circuit. Also, that it indicated that my language output circuit branched out into other parts of the brain.
Yeah.
And that might explain why my brain acts like a visual search engine. You put a keyword in, I just start to get pictures. Like, let's say, for example, I think about the glass airport concourse B in Chicago. Well, then I could get into a glass building file, and I'm seeing the biosphere in Arizona. I'm seeing the old Crystal Palace at the old World's Fair. I'm seeing our greenhouse. Or I could get an airport category and start seeing pictures of all the different airports. Basically, so my mind works like a search engine, and maybe that helps explain it. I mean, we need to be, in order to understand these things, we need to be looking at subjects based on kinds of thinking they have. Not everybody with autism is a visual thinker like me. Some are photorealistic visual thinkers. Others are more kind of mathematical minds. And then there's a third type that are more of a word-thinking mind. There tends to be an autism, good at one thing, bad at something else. That tends to be the pattern.
From something you said later in this book, I take it that early on in thinking in pictures, your revelation is that you did think in pictures, and that's different from a lot of people, and you thought that was the key to understanding autism. We know it's the key to understanding your autism, but then now you've discovered that there are some autistic people who do not think in pictures.
Well, that's right. And then I kind of discovered there was two kinds of visual thinking. There was photorealistic visual thinking like me, and then the more pattern thinker. This is the kid that can make the extreme origami, the little third grader that's just an ace in math, and he needs to be allowed to go ahead and do all the more advanced math. And then I was really happy when we were working on the book one night. I was surfing on the internet at 2 o'clock in the morning when I couldn't sleep, and I found journal articles, real scientific studies that validated the idea of two kinds of visual spatial thinking, the object, photorealistic visual thinker like me, and the more pattern mathematical thinker.
I'm going to come back to that later, but I know Joanne, and I think Richard still has it, but I can see questions on Joanne's face.
Well, when I first read about your revelation that you were a visual thinker, what occurred to me is then for you to succeed and to move forward in the world, you had to be exposed to a lot of experiences.
That's right.
And you had to go out and do things and all of that. And so, and I've seen you say there are parents who like sort of try and shelter their children, you know, and this could be to great detriment, can't it?
Well, you've got to get out and do things. You know, people with autism get scared easily, so no surprises. When I was 15, I was afraid to go to my aunt's ranch, and if I hadn't gone to my aunt's ranch, yeah, I wouldn't have had a career in the cattle industry. She gave me a choice, 2 weeks or all summer. Not going was not going to be one of the choices. But again, no surprises, because I'm a bottom-up thinker. The way I understand things is in downloading lots and lots of information into my head. And then the Google search engine inside my head has got stuff to search. Because to understand things in the future, I have to relate it back to something in the database.
Right.
But then the faulty thing, perhaps, I'm wondering about that search engine analogy, is that Google search gives me all these answers and pattern matches, but it doesn't synthesize any of that into the insights that you then provide. Where do those come from?
Well, you have to start putting things together. When I was in college, I called this finding the basic principle, and I did an undergraduate thesis on how one sensory system might alter the threshold of another sensory system. So I went and got all these journal articles, and then I did what I called my logic board. Now I do my logic board inside my own head, but I had this big, gigantic bulletin board, and then I kind of wrote the bottom line of 100 different journal articles on some pieces of paper. Review papers might have 20 different things, and I mixed them all up in the box, and I started pinning them up on the board and seeing what categories they would fall into, because all concepts for me are learned with specific examples, and then put those specific examples into categories. Like, for example, I put all the dogs in this category and all the cats that go in this category. Well, I kind of did the same thing with the journal articles. And you've got to kind of synthesize the stuff together. And how do I figure out things now? Let's take a medical issue. Okay, there's a lot of rubbish on the internet. Well, they're selling all kinds of weird supplements. That goes down to the bottom of the list because of the conflict of interest of money. That downranks the source of information. I like scientific journal articles, but I also find, for my own medical problems, that patient reports, like in chat rooms and message boards, some of that's extremely valuable. Mm-hmm. I find sort of like the patient reports and the scientific journal articles are my two best sources of information.
Mm-hmm.
That's really
Temple?
Interesting.
Temple, as an example of that, do you want to talk about the hearing loss that you were experiencing and how your kind of thinking, your bottom-up thinking, allowed you to kind of break out of the traditional way that people were thinking about how to diagnose this problem and how to solve it?
Well, about 7 years ago, I started getting tinnitus ringing in my ears, and then all of a sudden, I started losing hearing in one of my ears. And within 2 weeks, my ear went to where I could not hear a phone in it anymore. I was freaking out about going deaf. Mm-hmm. I go to the first doctor, and he sold lots of hearing aids. He's going to let me go deaf. Then I got on the internet. 2 weeks of freaking out, going through all the medical databases, downloading abstract after abstract after abstract. And one abstract would say, steroids work. You know, like prednisone works. Another one would say it doesn't work. Another one would say methotrexate works or some other drug. Another one says it doesn't work. Well, then I started noticing that all the best articles were in the Journal of Rheumatology. Why the Journal of Rheumatology? Why arthritis journals? Because it's autoimmune. And so it's an autoimmune thing. Mm. And then why does prednisone sometimes work and sometimes not work? And it came to a very simple conclusion. Well, if you have a fire in your house that starts in a wastebasket, and I put it out when it's in the wastebasket, I save the house. If I don't put it out fast, the house burns down. And basically, prednisone puts out the fire. It doesn't repair the damage.
Mm-hmm.
So for prednisone to work, you've got to give the prednisone before, way before the house burns down, or way before the ear is destroyed by the inflammation. So the doctor put me on prednisone, and I didn't know how to wean me off. So the problem came back. And then I borrowed a prescription for some ointment for a rash. It was betamethasone, powerful steroid. Powerful. I thought, boy, I'm going to wreck my adrenal with this stuff. I'm helping my ears. So then I went to dinner with the horse vet. It's cleared for horses. So I said, how long does it take the horse's adrenal to recover from betamethasone? And he said, 3 weeks. So then, like baseball players, I put it on here three times, 3 weeks apart, I was weaned off, saved my hearing. What I did have was Meniere's disease. I had to take diuretics for 5 years. So I'm now off the diuretics, but I did have to take those for 5 years. If I hadn't been as good a surfer of the internet, I would have lost my hearing.
But it also allowed you to think in a completely different way, so that the experts were mm-hmm. used to thinking about this problem in only one.
That's right.
Only one way, whereas you came to it, and because you accumulated all these details, the bottom-up thinking, that allowed you to make this kind of breakthrough and think in a completely different fashion about the
problem. Well, because I have stacks of abstracts, and mm-hmm. you know the drugs would work, the drugs would not work,
mm-hmm.
and all these different opposite findings. And then I just got kind of a revelation, a real simple reason. If you give the prednisone before the ear's wrecked, mm-hmm. it's like putting out the fire. Well, it's just in the wastebasket.
Well,
the house doesn't burn down.
This sounds like a great cue to introduce the idea from the book about the dangers of label-locked thinking, especially when it comes to autism. Autism is this. Autism is disease. Autism has deficiencies. We have to identify deficiencies. Everything is identified as a deficiency. This
well,
is label-locked thinking is bad
well,
stuff.
Well, I think half of people in Silicon Valley have some autism. We wouldn't mm-hmm. have this video conferencing tool that we're on right now.
Mm-hmm.
Who do you think invents this kind of stuff?
Mm-hmm.
Not that social people use it, but the social people are not the ones that invent it.
Yeah.
And I see kids coming up to me at meetings that are labeled autistic, and then I go to a gifted meeting. The same kid comes up to me, and he's just labeled gifted rather than autistic. You see, autism in the mild can have some advantages. Mm-hmm. You know, wouldn't have any scientists or artists and engineers if you didn't have a little bit of autism. In its more severe forms, you've got some really, really serious handicaps. But the thing that's driving me really crazy right now is I'm having smart kids coming up to me. They're fixated on their autism. That's all they want to talk about. And then when I go out in the meat industry, there's a guy that's out there in his 50s, and he's designing and building whole plants. And I'm sure he's on the spectrum. So the old ones... Mm-hmm. They went and took metal shop, wood shop, learned a bunch of hands-on stuff, and went on to industry. But I'm seeing too many smart, talented juniors sort of getting fixated on autism, and they're not getting out and doing things. And they're getting too sheltered. They aren't learning table manners. They aren't learning how to shop, just basic things.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And, I think I definitely agree where I see a lot of parents sheltering, and this we brought up before. I want to sort of get back to your book. So I saw a few general themes run through your book. One was, let's look at the neurological advances that we can get through different brain imaging, and then also the genomics. What are we understanding now that we can sequence the entire DNA and then sort of take a look at what's going in there? I saw your discussion about the DSM. How that it's so fluid, should we be calling these people autistic or not, based on whatever behavioral issues. And I enjoyed your discussion on sensory issues, which you say mm-hmm. go across all different disorders. My own daughter is on the spectrum, and she was pretty funny, when we started to try and get her to take showers, she couldn't because it was just too much stimulation. Mm-hmm. We couldn't get her hair cut for a really long time because we had to find just the right person who knew how to deal with that. And she still has issues, and she had to learn to deal with them. But, just a fork scraping on a plate will just send her, and she had to learn to deal with that. She's 17 now. But, sensory issues are really, really big. How do you counteract that? And then, of course, Temple, you're well known for your squeeze machine, which, you know, was very helpful with your sensory issues. And then the last part of the book that I thought was interesting was just your discussion, the two of you, talk about different kinds of minds and how they all work together. So what I'd like to do, now that I've sort of encapsulated the book, this is for our viewer who hasn't read the book, and I highly suggest. So are we anywhere near doing any genomic testing or testing? So let's say you have a little three-year-old that you think might be autistic. All we can do now is say, well, let's look at these categories in the DSM, and then we determine if they're on the spectrum. Are we anywhere near doing any sort of medical testing? I assume the fMRI.
Anything reliable right now. What I'm telling parents right now, if you got a two-year-old or a three-year-old that doesn't talk or is a lot of strange behavior, I don't care what label he has, the worst thing you can do is nothing. Mm-hmm. One place where all the practical research and all practical experience, all the research is very clear is you got to start working with that kid. Hours and hours of turn-taking games, teaching language, getting them to do games with other kids. You got to keep these kids engaged. That's the most important thing. And I'm finding that goes across a lot of different types of disabilities. When you have little kids that don't talk or don't socialize, you got to work with them. Now, you do have to be careful about sensory overload. You know, some kids, you got to be really gentle on that. So ask parents, well, what happens when you go into the big supermarket? Does he throw a fit in the big supermarket? Because if he does, then you've got really bad sensory problems. And one of my top areas for research would be sensory. They've done 100 papers for every paper that's done on sensory. But how can you be social? Okay, they've done 100 social papers. But how can you be social if you can't tolerate the environments where you do social things? You can't tolerate a noisy restaurant. And we've got to figure out these sensory issues and how to treat them, because they range from being a nuisance. Mine now are just nuisances. But for some people, they're completely debilitating.
Right, like certain sounds feel like an explosion in your head and actually feel painful. And I was actually surprised, because I remember that was something that the occupational therapists would emphasize, and the things I was learning and reading to help my daughter was so much emphasis on the sensory issues. But it's interesting, when I read your book, like that, you know, has anybody really written a book or done a lot of studies, and you indicated no, and I was like, wow, that's pretty amazing. And I just had to work. It was like, well, what tools can I give my daughter so she can handle being in flickering fluorescent lights, and what tools, and you know, she learned, she was smart enough to know, like, if she acted up, this sort of disrupted the whole day, you know.
I think the problem is that the behavioral profiles, like dyslexia or autism, not every dyslexic has a problem with fluorescent lights. Only a small portion does. Not every person with autism has a problem with fluorescent lights. You see, to study sensory problems, we're going to need to study specific sensory problems, regardless of the other labels. Like, let's study people that have severe problems with fluorescent lights. I'm finding in my livestock handling class, 1 out of 60 students each semester has this problem. These students cannot draw. I ask them to draw a circle, they draw scribbles. And then I ask them, do you see the print jiggle on the page when you read? Do fluorescent lights flicker? Do you hate driving at night? Mm-hmm. Do you hate escalators? Those are my screening questions. And then I get them to try some colored glasses, try some colored paper, colored backgrounds on their computers, different fonts. And they find that that helps. But again, this problem with the fluorescent lights varies from being very debilitating to being just slight nuisance. Now, we need to study sensory issues by specific sensory issue, regardless of other labels.
Don't we have a new understanding, a new availability of insights about things like sensory issues? It was a bit of a revelation for me when you're writing about sensory issues, and we used to think of autistic people as being withdrawn, as though somehow they weren't being stimulated. And you point out that if someone appears unaffected by some noise, perhaps, that there can be several sources. One can be that they're not hearing the noise, and that's a sensory problem. The other could be that the noise is overstimulating, and they just have to try to shut it out. And these are two extreme cases that require very different approaches. But if you're in that label-locked area and don't have the shift in perspective that accommodates it, you don't see those things. And that seems to be shifting around. You seem to be bringing a lot of that shift in perspective that's leading to more results rather than just useless diagnoses.
Well, that's why we can move past now, or it's advisable to move past the behavioral profile mm-hmm. and look at the individual symptoms.
And well, particularly neurological, which I think of right. as more realistic.
Well, there's actually been a lot of neurological research on things like face recognition and the social issues. Mm-hmm. Those are probably, if the autistic behavioral profile's got one core deficit, it's going to be the social stuff. And mm-hmm. the thing that's ironic is that there's been MRI around that can diagnose that for years, mm-hmm. and it's not being used.
But and because that social stuff we think of as social, psychological things, but we can find now that there is a neurological basis associated with some deficiencies in facial recognition that actually can be at the root of something like that, right?
I didn't even know that people had all these secret little eye signals, like rolling your eyes means mm-hmm. they don't like something. I didn't even know about that until I was 50. That would have been about over 15 years ago, and I read about it in a book.
That's pretty interesting. I feel fortunate with my daughters. Like, I have four kids. The two older was a boy and a girl, so she got to watch and observe. She observed so carefully. How does a socially adept male act? How does a socially adept female act? And then she had a younger brother who was 3 years younger. So emotionally, they were such a match and made great playmates. So I feel like, you know, boy, if there's got to be a family situation that worked for her, that was it. So I was really grateful because, you know, the social, you can see there's a very definitive, I'm going to watch and learn. And I assume that's what you had to do, Temple. It's like I have to observe.
That's right.
Like an alien from another planet. I have to observe and learn how to deal with people.
I call it acting in the play. You got to learn how to act in the play. I had to learn that if I talked on and on and on about the same subject over and over again, people got bored with that. So then I had a rule. I could tell that story twice, and then that's it.
That's a good rule.
Yeah.
I'd like to move on to how you and Richard work together mm-hmm. on this book. Because, of course, Temple, you've been known. You've been such, you know, so helpful in your ability to explain what's going on in your head and relating that. And so you've written many books and really opened our eyes to what it's like to be on the spectrum. So in writing your book, then, you decided to join forces with Richard. And so I'm curious how this came about and what you saw as benefits and what you saw as, you know, what... How was this going to further your message more by working with Richard?
Well, as a person with an associative thinker, a bottom-up thinker, I tend to not be very organized. Now, when I do scientific papers, I have no problems with being organized because it's real rigid format, abstract, intro, methods, you know, then you have the animals and you got what you fed them and you got, you know, how you measured things, results, and discussion. And if you want to read my technical writing, there's plenty of it on Google Scholar and plenty of it on Grandin.com. But when you get into something bigger like a book and I got to organize it, that's where I don't do so well. And Richard was really good, especially on figuring out some of the genetics stuff. We did long interviews talking about stuff. Also, one thing I did do is I sometimes sent Richard so many journal articles, didn't know what to do with them. But then there were certain things, certain papers, that were absolutely crucial, you know, like the PET scan that showed the two different kinds of visual minds. I was able to pick out what I call the critical papers, say, yeah, these have got to be in the book. Mm-hmm. But then there was a whole bunch of other stuff that, you know, Richard had to sift through and kind of make sense of. Because I still have problems with structure and organization, and that's typical of associative thinkers like me.
Well, I think that one thing that I brought to the collaboration was this kind of my ignorance about autism. I really came to it with needing to have a very steep learning curve. And one of the first questions I asked was a natural one, I think, which is, what is autism? I mean, what actually is it? How do we define it? And that kind of really basic question opens up all sorts of doors about how has the diagnosis changed over the years? What is the meaning of the diagnosis? How reliable is it? And so on and so forth. So you get into all these bigger issues. To my surprise, I found that I would pick up books about autism and they wouldn't explain the history of the diagnosis. And I felt like there's like this fundamental piece missing where we don't actually know what we're talking about. We haven't really established the terms, and especially something like autism, where the definition keeps changing over the years. So I wanted to trace that whole thing. And that, I mean, I think that opened my eyes. I think it opened Temple's eyes to a certain extent, too, about how unreliable this diagnosis has been and how amorphous.
Well, I knew it had changed from a psychological to a neurological, but I have to say I was shocked when I saw how the DSMs have changed every decade or so over the years and laid it all out and read it all at the same time. I thought it was quite shocking, actually.
It's an eye-opener, really, to have to recount that. I have a question on this subject, Joanne, but I have a subordinate question that precedes it, I think. And the two books that I know best from Temple are, I guess, your first one is Thinking in Pictures, and then now I've just read The Autistic Brain, excuse me. And so the picture I get of Temple Grandin's books is a continuing research report on her self-analysis experiments and self-reporting. It's like, what's the source of that, Temple? Why do you feel this drive to let people know what's going on in your head?
Well, I think it's going to help a lot of parents and teachers understand what's going on in their kids' heads. And I've had parents say to me, especially on my book, Thinking in Pictures, now I understand how my child thinks. I've had several wives come up to me at the airport and saying, you saved my marriage. I now understand how my engineering husband thinks. People find that useful. Also, I find it fascinating to see how my mind is similar to others and how my mind is different, because I'm really interested in how different minds can work together. You know, right now in education, there's a lot of emphasis on STEM and on learning math. But you need us visual thinkers like us, because let's look at Fukushima nuclear power plant. They made a design mistake that I would never make. I can't do the math for designing a reactor, but there's no way I'd put the emergency generators in a non-waterproof basement where they're going to flood.
Yeah.
Now, what I realized is that the engineers couldn't see the water coming in there. I can see the water smashing out the air louvers and flooding those generators, and all I know about a nuclear power plant is if the cooling pumps don't work, I'm in tons of trouble.
Yeah. Now that flows naturally into the question about pattern word thinkers, picture thinkers, spatial thinkers, and the need for them to work together. So is this book, The Autistic Brain, was it your experiment in having a picture thinker and a pattern word thinker work together, and how did the experiment go? It seemed to work out
I thought
well,
it worked out really well, and I want to give another example of a pattern, you know, pattern thinkers and visual thinkers working together. Steve Jobs, for example, was an artist. Mm-hmm. He came up with the interface for the iPad and the iPhone. The engineers had to make the insides work. Mm-hmm. You know, you need that's another example of two kinds of minds that are working together to make a really great project. And I get worried with all this emphasis on STEM education of my kind of mind being marginalized. You need my kind of mind so the hackers don't bring down the power grid.
We're good with that. And Joanne and I have been hearing more about adding an A for art and calling it STEAM. And we think that's a fabulous thing to do, because you need all of that to have the necessary creativity and all of the insights you can get. Richard, how did the experiment work for you? What did you learn from it?
I think that Temple's hypothesis, and going into the book, it was a hypothesis that there were these three kinds of thinkers instead of two kinds, was really borne out, as we said earlier, by a researcher at Harvard, Maria Kozhevnikov, who did the hard science studies that demonstrated this. And one point that I think is really worth underscoring is that when we're talking about pattern thinking and picture thinking, We're talking about two really distinct things. I think mm-hmm. probably the temptation or the tendency is to say they're both visual thinkers. Well, they are both mm-hmm. visual thinkers, but mm-hmm. let's break them out and see them as distinct from each other as picture thinking is from verbal thinking, mm-hmm. for instance. That they really and that's what the neurological studies are showing, is that they really do operate in different parts of the brain, the pattern thinker and the picture thinker. Mm-hmm. Different parts of the brain light up.
They deserve to be broken out. Yeah. I think I'm a physical scientist. I'm also a musician. I'm probably a pattern thinker.
There you go.
The picture thinking sounds familiar and yet foreign in so many ways, because it manipulates things that are not words, and I don't understand the idea of people who think that you have to have words to think are even more foreign to me. But the patterns are much different. It happens in a different way from the pictures.
Mm-hmm. Maybe you might want to give me a key word, and I can just kind of tell you how my picture mind brings up. Give me something interesting, not something boring like house or car.
Oh, shoot, because I'm looking at a tree right now, but, what about...
I'm looking at a tree, too. Give me something that I'm not looking at.
Wait, can I say something here? Temple tried this experiment with me once, and not being autistic, I said, fence. And Temple said, well, what kind of fence are you talking about? Yeah. And then she listed like 18 different kinds of fences. And I said, okay, point taken.
And I saw every one of them.
Right.
Yeah. I was having a discussion this morning with someone about solar panel because of things we've had installed on our roof recently. But is that amenable to thinking of pictures? Surely. Solar panels.
Yes. I am seeing... a solar panel on an African hut, so now his cell phone works. I'm seeing some solar panels on people's houses. I'm also seeing solar panels that were mounted on top of a British petroleum building, I think, is a publicity stunt.
Yes, I think so. Well, then how do you deal with overload? Like if you suddenly have, I say, what about doors? You've surely seen an awful lot of doors.
Oh, I'm starting to see doors. I just saw the door on our cattle handling building, because just last week mm-hmm. we had cattle lab. It was very, very hot. So now I'm into the heat stress file folder in my mind. It's very, very hot here. I'm thinking now about the different places I was very hot in, like my own house.
Yes.
Wow. Yeah, that's a lot of information to keep in. I'd like to ask a question specifically for Richard right now, that your first book is The 4% Universe.
Not my first book. I've got a number
sorry.
Of books. No, it's fine.
Well, okay, I'm so sorry. But
no,
the first book I read of you, your previous book, which I really love, I really admired. A friend pointed it out to me, and I thought, well, actually, that sounds really interesting. And so you were looking at cosmology, essentially, or astrophysics. You can probably correct me on the correct term to use. And you're just laying out, like, when did we start first thinking there was dark matter, and who did that thinking, and how did that progress and proceed? And so you told this wonderful story that almost had me thinking I could understand this. Why don't you tell me a little bit about that, and then how that is different from working with Temple, like completely switching gears? Like, you must be a very flexible science writer, you know. So, which one were you more comfortable with, actually?
Well, I have a background. My background, my formal background, educational background, is both in journalism and in fiction. I have an MFA in fiction and an undergraduate degree in journalism. And at a certain point in my life, I saw that I could combine the two, so that I could tell nonfiction stories, that is, stick with the facts, make everything factual, but tell it as if it were a novel, mm-hmm. a story, and pay attention to narrative. So I think that's what you're talking about with the 4% universe, that there were narratives there, and there were characters and dialogue and so on, and action and conflict and rising action and falling action and all the usual qualities of narrative writing. So for me, coming into the project with Temple, it was really more of the same in that regard. I mean, a completely different topic, of course. As I said earlier, I started from knowing just about nothing about the topic, but that's what I do with with my other work, with the astrophysics and cosmology, is I come to it without knowing anything much about dark matter or dark energy, and I just go, where did these ideas come from, and how did they evolve, and what do they mean in the bigger picture? And those are the kinds of questions that I brought to autism.
Does not knowing, you think, give you more empathy for your potential reader?
Oh, absolutely. No, that's key, actually, that I take my learning process and I try to make that into part of the narrative, so that if I'm writing about, let's say, a scientist who's investigating supernovae or something, I try to put myself and therefore the reader kind of standing shoulder to shoulder with that person, because to that person everything makes sense. To the outsider it might be overwhelming, but to that person they're asking very simple questions, and if you put yourself into their frame of mind, then you need to understand what the history was that got them to this point, what are the stakes in what they're investigating, and where do we go from here. And that's what I tried to do with this collaboration with Temple, is to, in effect, stand shoulder to shoulder with Temple and say, how did we get here? What do these things mean? Where do we go from here? Mm-hmm. Temple was absolutely great to work with. 11 a.m. my time, 9 a.m. her time, Sunday morning, the phone would ring and she'd be ready to go. It was great. I mean,
And one of the things I did with you is I'd ask for homework.
That's right.
Specific things, like we're working on a certain part of the book, and because I like kind of well-defined projects, I said, okay, now I'm going to go search journal articles and get my thoughts together on a particular area for this phone call.
Mm-hmm. Empathy for the reader is a big tie-in, and also just for the scientific discovery, because you talk in the book about the need to listen more, to ask the autistic person what's going on, not to presume that we know and that they can't judge. And this is what these books have been. This has been you talking about your own autism, hearing what that's about, and showing us that we need, if we want to know more about what's going on in the mind of an autistic person, perhaps we should ask the autistic person.
Well, that's absolutely right, and I think this is especially true on the sensory issues, and that's why the sensory chapter is a really important chapter in the autistic brain. And the thing that kind of upsets me, because I've been talking about this for years, is I wish researchers would put a lot higher priority on the sensory issues, because they can make it just impossible for the person to live in the regular world of a noisy office, a noisy supermarket or restaurant or something like that. And I think it's difficult sometimes for normal people to relate to a sensory reality that's different. They can relate to the social. So we have 100 social studies for every study that's been done on sensory. Well, we've done enough studies on the social. We actually have a diagnostic technology for that we're not using. Let's work on this sensory stuff and figure out how to do treatments for it so the person can be in the environment to be social.
Right.
In the book, we make the distinction between theory of mind, which are the studies that Temple's referring to that have been done and done and done, where we try to understand the mind, the psychology of the autistic person. But it's like the researchers lack a theory of brain. They're not seeing it. They're not seeing what the actual visceral feeling. Jeff, you mentioned earlier that what appears different from the outside, shutting down or going into into a kind of manic state, might feel, those two visually different experiences might feel on the inside completely the same. So that's the difference between looking at it from the outside in or the inside out.
I had a doctor one time say to me, and he was an autism doctor, he says, well, I don't understand the sound sensitivity stuff. I said, imagine a dentist drill hitting a nerve, but it's in your ear. Okay, now do you get that? Now, of course, that's a real extreme case. And I think sometimes you can desensitize sound sensitivity, touch sensitivity, where the kid doesn't want to be hugged, to be desensitized with deep pressure. That's really important to do that. Some of these visual problems, we need to figure out how to treat these things and treat them in a specific way for a specific problem.
Right. And I mean, I can really relate because here I had a child with these issues and we wouldn't understand why she'd be so upset and we had to get in and figure this out. I also like the point you brought up, Temple, about like you told Richard you wanted homework. You want a specific task. And there is someone here who sent a question going, I'm having difficulty holding a job because of my Asperger's. Is there a particular skill I can utilize to keep me focused on the job instead of becoming frustrated over not understanding a particular reason to do a job that I don't find necessary? So he seems he doesn't see a reason why he has to do this thing. And so, you know, there's some disconnect. And is
I did design work. So what I learned very early on is that when we had a project meeting, was to sit down and what are the parameters for this job? Budget, I want to get an idea about the amount of money they're going to spend, how much stuff we're going to rip up and remodel. If it's new construction, where the property lines are, what the project's supposed to do when it's done, what's the outcome of it. Now, I'll do the designing, but I got to know what it's got to do. Let's say somebody's working for doing programming. Well, you don't just say, don't design new software. You ask them to design a piece of software that does some specific outcome. And then you give them some time to get it done in. Maybe it has to be in a certain language. You give them the parameters. So I think a lot of things on a job, you can sit down with the boss and discuss, okay, what do you really need to have done? Now, maybe the boss just has some silly quirks that he wants you to do. Well, then you just do it. And it's stupid, and you just have to do it. You know, like maybe he wants something really dumb done with the coffee. Well, then you do it. Because it's not worth fighting over.
You know, right.
I've come to that conclusion. Mm-hmm. But I like measurable metrics. Okay, then we get the job built, and did it do the things it was supposed to do? Vague does not work with people with autism.
Right.
Doesn't mm-hmm. work. You've got to tell them exactly what is expected in the job. You know, one of the first things is be on time and show up for work. And there's some kids that are not doing that. And this is why I'm pushing now for paper route substitutes. When kids are 12 and 13 years old, we need to find things that we can substitute for paper route to teach that discipline of work, mm-hmm. like maybe walk dogs for the next door neighbors, maintain a local website, you know, help a couple of old people buy their groceries. But they've got to learn that there's a discipline to a job. That's the first thing. And the other thing is sassing back at the boss. Maybe the boss is an idiot, but you don't tell him.
Yes, you don't. Not if you want to keep a job.
Exactly. And I have a lot of stuff in the autistic brain on the whole job thing.
Right. Well, and you have a lot of practical information out there on your website, thetemplegrandin.com. Mm-hmm. I mean, that has been invaluable to me, and I know other parents, you know, about keeping kids on task and making sure they have a lot of experiences.
I'm seeing too many kids getting addicted to video games. So we need to limit that kind of idle screen time to an hour a day. They want to learn how to do programming. They can spend a lot more time on the screen, but not playing video games. So they can't get a job as a beta tester for video games.
not often, anyway. So you know, Jeff and I, obviously, we run this read science because we're pretty strong believers in doing a lot more reading mm-hmm. versus TV watching or
computer time.
One of the characteristics that makes your voice so useful, Temple, I think, in addition to hearing about autism from the inside rather than the outside in a very useful way, is that you talk about it with such candor. And you're very open and I sort of delight in reading things like, here it is, and to hear you say things like, this part of my brain doesn't work well, I need to work around it this way. And I wonder how much negative feedback you get from people who feel you aren't being sensitive enough to seeing things in a positive light. And, you know, don't they see you? I see you as saying something positive by saying, here is something that we can recognize doesn't work the way everyone else's brain does. If I want to do something, I need to recognize that versus denial or ignoring things or...
Well, I couldn't become an expert skier. I just don't have enough cerebellum. But the thing that I am really good at is the visual thinking. I'm a mm-hmm. big believer in taking the kid's area of strength because in a lot of developmental disabilities and a lot of different labels, kids have uneven skills. Good at one thing, terrible at something else. Build on the thing they're good at. I've seen schools do really bad things like, okay, we're going to give this kid two extra periods of math and take him out of band. That's the worst thing you can do. Band's his only reason for going to school. Music is something you can turn into a career. You want to build on the thing that they can do. And basically what my cattle designing career is industrial design. It's an actual field called industrial design. Another kid, it's going to be computer programming. I had access to the same computer that Bill Gates had access to.
Yeah.
And he could do it, and I couldn't. I found out I got water in the left parietal area. So,
so rather than trying to make all kids come out of the school factory the same, we have to take the extra effort and time to work with what they're really good at and turn them into something they're good at.
Well, on one thing I'm concerned about, I'm hearing too many parents telling me they got a third or fourth grader who's a little very, very smart in math, and the school will not let him go ahead and get the fifth grade, sixth grade, seventh grade, eighth grade math book. I'm saying let that kid go. He's going to need special ed and reading. That tends to be the pattern, not always. But if that kid can do college math on a laptop in the classroom, let him do it.
Yeah.
Don't hold him back.
Because he's going to be discouraged if you don't,
exactly.
And that discouragement happens pretty early on, doesn't it?
And they get bored and they turn into behavior problems. And the
kid
that really
was good sensory.
At art.
This is an this is an extension
and
of what we've been talking about.
Okay, Richard.
Yeah, this is an extension of what we've been talking about, seeing things on a symptom-by-symptom basis. The logical extension of that is now you can see the person on an individual-by-individual basis. So rather than saying, oh, that kid's autistic, let's put him in that group over there, you say, what specifically is the problem that we need to address, or what is the strength that we need to address? Is the kid, you know, as Temple is saying, if he's great in math, give him a more advanced math book. And,
well, and
you know, in Temple's experience, she wasn't good with algebra, and she says now maybe that they should have just skipped algebra and gone straight to geometry for her.
Well, we get an insight that's akin to the insight about the sensory problems that a similar symptom can come from overstimulation or understimulation. So we have problem children who might be the typical broken home miscreant or something, and then we have the ones who are bored because they can't do calculus in fourth grade or something.
Great point. Great point.
Yeah. I have a couple of what I think of as my Barbara Walters questions. one in particular that I wanted to get to, but I was thinking and I looked up the date of Thinking in Pictures because I read it soon after it came out, I think because I heard Temple being interviewed by Terry Gross or someone at the time, and we said, oh, we've got to read that book. And I could not believe that it's been about 20 years ago that that happened. Now, since that time, Temple, you have been talking an awful lot about autism to an awful lot of people. And so the inner Barbara says, how has that changed you? What have you learned and how have you grown? And you know, what's that experience been like for you?
Well, I'm always learning. Because when I wrote Thinking in Pictures, I made the mistake of thinking that everybody on the autism spectrum thought in pictures. And then I read some Amazon reviews. And that made me made me start questioning other people. And then I started learning about the word thinker. And then I learned about the math thinker. And I find that I'm always learning things. Every day I learn something new, add more information to the database. I also have found as I got older, I think I've gotten better at thinking. Because I got more data inside here from my internal Google to Google.
That's really good. I have a question for you, Temple, that's based on your work. Because, of course, you have, you know, really done more for livestock and cattle handling and the humane aspect of that by understanding animals and creating handling systems that keep them from being as stressed for their end here, but it just occurred to me that I was talking to someone and said something about, you know, poultry handling seems to get a lot of criticism. Do you feel as connected to birds as you do to mammals? Because of course you work with cattle, but you're also known for connecting with dogs and you know, pigs and all of that. So do you feel like birds are something you can relate to as easily as cattle?
Well, I think I probably relate more to cattle, but birds, all animals, are sensory-based thinkers. And then you take the corvid birds, things like crows and blue jays, they actually have quite a bit more brain than chickens have got. But there's actually been quite a bit of improvement in some of the poultry handling systems. There's new stunning systems where they no longer have to hang the live birds on the rail anymore. That's a real improvement. Research has shown that's really highly stressful to the animals. The other thing I want to emphasize on animal handling is that good equipment makes good handling possible, but you have to have the management to go along with it.
Mm-hmm.
When I was really young, I thought I could fix everything with engineering and equipment. No. I can only fix half of the problems with engineering and equipment, and the other half's management. So I developed a scoring system for scoring the performance of slaughter plants. Like how many cattle are mooing and bellowing when you're handling them? You're only allowed 3 out of 100. How many cattle fall down during handling? You know, how many, then when you shoot them with a captive bolt, you got to get them dead. And when I first started working on this and I measured it, it was terrible because the equipment was broken. They didn't take care of their equipment. Well, now that's gone up to like 97, 98% working perfectly every time. It's never going to get to be 100% perfect, but in the bad old days, 15 years ago, 20 years ago, it was really terrible because they just let their stuff break. Mm-hmm. They just weren't managing it.
Mm-hmm. It's the importance of bringing together the pattern thinkers, the word thinkers, the picture thinkers, and getting them all together on the same project.
That's right.
So I see we have about 4 minutes left, which I think is enough time to allow both of you to say something that either we forgot to ask you or you feel is really, really important, either to tie things together or something you wanted to say since the beginning of this discussion. So, Richard, why don't we allow you to go first? Oh, we've got two Richards here. Richard, did you hear our question for you?
No. That's the second time during this call that I dropped out. So if you
that's
could repeat
okay.
that, please.
Yeah, absolutely. So I was saying we're looking at about 4 minutes left in this discussion. I wanted to ask both you and Temple if you would like to share something that maybe we hadn't asked you or you feel is very important that our audience know about before we sign off. So why don't we go with you first, Richard?
No, we covered so much in this talk. It's really been comprehensive. One thing I will say is that we were talking about how Temple has changed over the years and how she's aware of, you know, she says, well, here's where I have a problem or here's where I can't do something. I was told before I started working with Temple that I was told by her agent that it's okay to interrupt her and say, you already said that. And of course, you know, that idea horrified me, and I had to really get over all of those social restrictions saying you don't do that. You can't say that to somebody. And eventually I worked up the courage. I said to Temple, well, you already said that. She said, oh, I did? Okay, fine. And then she just moved on. I thought, oh, okay, so there's no ego involved in this. I can just say that. And it was that was great.
That's great. Temple, so you may not have heard because I saw you dropped out for a second there, but we're just going to be wrapping things up. Is there anything in particular you'd really like to share with our audience before we sign off?
I just want to emphasize the importance of developing a child's strengths. Find things he's good at. Build up on those things. My ability in art was always encouraged. And I used to just draw the same horse head over and over again. I was encouraged to draw many, many different things. The other thing, we need to start teaching work skills. That needs to start around 12, 13 years old with paper route substitutes. And it's been absolutely wonderful being on this video conference. And thank you so much for having me.
Thank you, Temple. And go Illini. I know you're an alumni. This is where I work.
Okay.
You got your PhD.
Yep.
Yeah, well, our cheers won't help the team very much, I don't think.
Okay. Well, we're go Rams now.
That's I said, my son is in grad school there, so yeah, I can say go Rams just as easily. So
okay.
I have no affiliations. All right. Well, thank you both, Richard and Temple. It's been a great pleasure to have you both here. And on behalf of Scientific American and Read Science and my co-host, Jeff, thanks to everybody who stayed here and watched and added your questions to the discussion. All right. Thanks.
It's been great. Thanks.
Thank you.
All right. Bye,
thank
everybody.
You.